You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a federal judge has blocked a Trump administration rule that would allow many healthcare workers to refuse to provide certain services on religious or moral grounds. Wisconsin was involved in that lawsuit. An expert on healthcare joins the show for a look at what that decision means. Now, it's Veterans Day today, and a new documentary from PBS is taking a closer look at a group of vets who aren't always recognized, Native Americans. Warrior Tradition airs tonight at 8 o'clock on PBS Wisconsin. It tells the history of Native American service in the U.S. military from, well, before America was America through today. Patty Lowe appears in the documentary. Patty's a professor at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University, co-director there of the Center for Native American and Indigenous Research. She's also an enrolled citizen of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe. Patty, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks so much, Rob. It's wonderful to be with you.
Do you think, Patty, the culture at large is aware of the role Native Americans have played in the U.S. military historically and to this day?
You know, I don't think so. I think ours is a pretty invisible group in general, and we don't really think much about Native American military service. And I think a lot of people are surprised to learn that Native Americans serve in numbers three times higher than any other race or ethnicity, given their numbers.
And can you talk about the ways Native Americans honor veterans among them?
Well, I think if you go into any Native community, you will see veterans occupy a pretty elevated status in our communities. At powwows, they're the first ones into the dance arena. There are ceremonies where it's only veterans that can do a prescribed ritual. We have always been able to separate the war from the warrior. So even when mainstream America was kind of struggling with what to do with its Vietnam vets, we didn't have that same problem in Indian country.
And you've got a personal family background here. Your grandfather, you talk about this in the documentary, enrolled in the Wisconsin National Guard. Can you share his story?
Sure. I produced a documentary 12 years ago called The Way of the Warrior. That's a different documentary than what's airing tonight. This is a documentary produced by WNED in New York and features some of the same themes. But the one that you're referring to, the one that I produced for Wisconsin Public Television, told small stories that spoke to larger themes. And my grandfather's story really began in an Indian boarding school where Native children were placed, and the motto was "Kill the Indian, save the man." And it was run very militaristically. They marched to the dining hall, they marched to the mess hall, they marched to classes, and they drilled. At 5 o'clock in the morning, my grandfather and his fellow classmates put on little drill outfits and drilled with wooden rifles. So when World War I broke out and they were looking for troops, although my grandfather served first in the Wisconsin National Guard, it was pretty much a seamless transition from Indian boarding schools to training camps to the front lines.
We're talking to Patty Lowe, professor at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University, co-director of the Center for Native American and Indigenous Research. Talk about Native Americans in the U.S. military. New documentary airs tonight. It's called Warrior Tradition on PBS Wisconsin. That's on tonight at 8. And, Patty, I understand there's ambivalence sometimes, given the background you were just talking about, and I think this was in your documentary, a code talker talking about how his Navajo language was rejected, suppressed, and then all of a sudden, come World War II, it was celebrated in an urgent part of national security. Can you talk about that?
Boy, you know, Rob, I'm so glad you brought that up, because that, to me, is one of the ultimate ironies. You know, Indian boarding schools were all about assimilating Native people, and that included wiping out their traditions, their languages, and children that attempted to speak their Native language were often physically beaten, you know, or had their mouths washed out with soap. And then here, you know, in World War II, a lot of people, you know, when they think about code talking, they think about the Navajo code talkers of World War II, but actually there were Choctaw code talkers in World War I. And this was during the height of the assimilation efforts, you know, stateside. And yet the fact that these Native men could communicate with each other in a language that the Germans couldn't, and not only was it a language that the Germans couldn't didn't understand, but also encoded it with codes that had, you know, double security. So the Germans were never able to crack the codes during World War I, and the codes were never cracked during World War II either.
And you also talk in your documentary about how Native Americans are able to, in some ways, spiritually prepare people for service before they enter in a way that maybe other cultures could learn from.
Yeah, and you know, and I think that's a thread that Larry Hott, the producer of this Warrior Tradition documentary that airs tonight, I think that that's something he explores in a really fine way. Native communities seem to understand that when you ask a man or woman now to, to perhaps make the ultimate sacrifice, that's a spiritual act. I mean, when you're preparing to take a life or perhaps give your own, there's nothing more spiritual than that. And Native communities have rituals that address that, as well as rituals that attempt to purify these men and women when they come back from seeing, you know, the horrors of war. You don't want to introduce a poison back into your community. We've turned these individuals from people of peace into people who kill. So that sacrifice that that individual has made is a sacrifice on behalf of a community, and it's a community obligation to that individual to help that man or woman transition from a person of war back to a person of peace, not just for their benefit, but for the benefit of the community.
And before we let you go, Patty, what's your reaction to the Trump administration's decision to make November National American History and Founders Month? It had already been Native American Heritage Month.
You know, I think it was really disappointing to me, and it seems like it was something that was very intentional and deliberate. You know, we have 2 months that have no history designations at all. That's July and August. And to me, July seems like an obvious month to celebrate American history and founders, you know, because of the 4th of July. It just seemed like a natural. So for the president to choose November seemed to be a pretty deliberate attempt to minimize this month for Native people. And, you know, I wonder if it's because of the efforts on the part of municipalities and townships all over the country and states to instate Indigenous Peoples Day.
Okay.
I'm a professional communicator. You think I do a better job of this. You know, there's a trend to replace Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day, and I'm wondering if this is maybe a reaction to that, because it just doesn't make sense to me.
Patty, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Appreciate it.
That's Patty Lowe, professor at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University and co-director of the Center for Native American Indigenous Research. She joined us today to talk about Native Americans and U.S. military service. A new documentary called Warrior Tradition from PBS airs tonight at 8 on PBS Wisconsin. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about a group of heroes from World War I.
Way before cell phones, there were these things called telephones. And in the early days, a telephone call required a switchboard operator to make the connection.
Operator,
one moment, please.
Thank you.
Writer Meg Jones tells the story of a group of switchboard operators whose skill and courage on the front lines helped the U.S. win World War I.
100 years ago, a group of patriotic Americans boarded ships in New York and headed off to war. They wore U.S. Army Signal Corps uniforms, were fluent in English and French, and were sent to France to fill a critical need in communications during World War I. The fact that they were female set them apart from the millions of other Americans in uniform in Europe. They were called the Hello Girls because of their jobs. They were telephone operators who handled calls by American and Allied troops fighting at the front throughout France. Just as radios were integral during World War II, in 1918, telephones were the military's best way to communicate. And the country that led the world in telephone technology was the United States. Here in America, most phone operators were women. They sat at switchboards and connected calls by plugging in long cords. When General John Pershing arrived in France, he quickly realized he needed experienced telephone operators, so he convinced the Army to send female volunteers. More than 7,000 women offered to go, and 223 were ultimately selected and sent to France. In fact, two of the women were from Wisconsin, Martina Hainan from Green Bay and Hildegard Van Brunt from Milwaukee. Now, this was 2 years before women were even allowed to vote in the United States. Every command to advance or retreat or hold fire was delivered by telephone, and it took an operator to connect that call. French officers frequently needed to communicate with their American counterparts, and it was the Hello Girls who put those calls through and stayed on the line to act as simultaneous translators. Before they arrived in France, it was taking male phone operators as long as 60 seconds to connect a call. When the American women arrived, the timing was cut to just 10 seconds. As they quickly, calmly, and efficiently handled numerous calls, they were privy to national security secrets and frequently served near the front lines. Some came under bombardment. Two phone operators never returned home, victims of the Spanish flu epidemic. The women were among the last Americans to leave Europe after the war, handling phone calls until the Treaty of Versailles was signed. Ultimately, they connected 26 million calls and proved to be a significant factor in winning the war. The Hello Girls were proud of the work they had done in France, and when they returned home, they tried to join veterans groups. When they were asked for their discharge papers, the phone operators contacted the Defense Department for the required paperwork. And that's when the Army told them they were not veterans. Even though they had signed oaths as members of the U.S. Army Signal Corps, worn uniforms, saluted officers, were frequently in danger, and not free to leave whenever they wanted, the Army said basically, "Oh, didn't we tell you? You were just well-paid civilians." Which was heartbreaking for many of the women. They didn't get medals or bonuses given to every member of the armed services. They didn't get medical benefits given to every other American who served in uniform during World War I. They couldn't call themselves veterans or march in Memorial Day parades. Some of the Hello Girls petitioned Congress and the military for decades and were repeatedly rebuffed in their attempts to be called veterans. Finally, in 1977, President Jimmy Carter signed legislation recognizing what should have been done 6 decades earlier. By then, only a handful of the phone operators were still alive. One of them told her family the long fight to become a veteran meant she could have something so many of her fellow phone operators had been denied, a flag in her coffin when she died.
Meg Jones is a reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and the author of World War II Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Now, the black-necked stilt might sound like an obscure kind of tool maybe for doing yard work. It's actually the name of a bird found typically in Gulf states that's been known to visit us here in Wisconsin. It sounds like this. According to more than 30 nests biologists found this year at Horicon Marsh National Wildlife Refuge, the stilts are becoming a more common sight here in the state. Sumner Madison is a conservation biologist specializing in birds with the Wisconsin DNR. He's one of the people who found these colonies. Sumner, welcome back to Central Time.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, describe the black-necked stilt for us, please.
So the black-necked stilt is unique in appearance among all shorebirds. It is a two-toned bird with beautiful black wings and a black back, and mostly a black head, and then it's white underneath, so it's a black and white shorebird. But what's unique about this bird, other than that its coloration, is it has extremely long legs, beautiful rose pink colored legs that are about 8 to 9 inches long. So this makes for a very remarkable sighting.
And this was a very rare sighting historically in Wisconsin, right? Not like they never, ever showed up here, but it was a rarity, right?
Right. Prior to 1990, we had only 4 historical records in the state.
Wow.
The first one was from 1847, April of 1847, near Racine. The second one was mid-May of 1951 at Horicon Marsh. The third one was August 1986. Also at Horicon National Wildlife Refuge. And the fourth one was in 1987 in Columbia County. But since the 1990s, we've seen a marked increase in the number of stilts.
And these are birds that we thought maybe were popping by and visiting, but now you're finding nests in Horicon Marsh.
That's right. We actually had our first recorded nest of black-necked stilts in 1999 during the first Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, which ran from 1995 to the year 2000. So we were very excited by the occurrence of this first nesting pair. Now for the second iteration of the Atlas, from 2015 to 2019, we've had birds breeding almost every year during this last five-year period.
Where do we typically think of the stilts breeding?
So typically they occur in the Gulf Coast, also along the southern Atlantic coast. And then there's also birds that occur in the far western, southwestern part of the United States, in California. So what we're seeing here is really since the 1990s is a dramatic and marked increase in the number of sightings in the Midwest. And the first confirmed breeding records in the Midwest was in Missouri in 1990. And then in Illinois and South Dakota in 1994, prior to Wisconsin's first record in 1999.
Okay, I feel like we're in a pretty different environment from the South Atlantic, the Gulf States, the Southwestern United States. What's going on? Why are they starting to breed here?
Yeah, so I think what's happening is it's really a reflection of climate change. It's hard to know for certain, but I think as sites have become more dry, the birds have moved farther north. But conversely, with flooding, this is why climate change is not just global warming, but both warming as well as severe storms. As we've seen flooding occur, some of these sites where they may have nested, if they haven't dried up, they might have been flooded. So we're seeing more and more birds expanding their range to the north.
Now, this is a bird that's not, we wouldn't say native to Wisconsin. Would we then think of it as an invasive species?
It's not an invasive species. It's really a bird that is native to North America for sure. Mm-hmm. It has occurred here very seldomly, as I mentioned before, but it's a bird that we're seeing in increasing number because of these changing habitat conditions to the south. So at Horicon this year, we were very surprised when Daryl Christensen and myself, my colleague Daryl Christensen, went out and looked. We were looking for some other marsh nesting birds, and I noticed a black-necked stilt driving away a killdeer. And I didn't really have a search image for black-necked stilt nesting habitat since I wasn't very familiar with that bird in Wisconsin. Although some people think I've lived that long. but what we found is that the birds were occupying these mud flats or peaty mud areas with decaying cattail stubs. And when I got closer to where this bird had been driving off the killdeer, I saw 4 chicks. And the first 4 stilt chicks that I had seen in my life. And then we looked at similar habitat where they were occurring. And sure enough, on these islets or islands of mud and sparse vegetation, across the marsh, they were also nesting. So it was very, very informative, very interesting to see this.
Are they going to? Do they leave here for the winter? Then
they leave here for the winter. They go down to the Gulf Coast. They also migrate. The species migrates to Central and South America. South America, they occur year round down there. But this is what's called a neotropical migrant bird because of its long distance migrations. Well, time will tell whether or not we will see this many again at Horicon Marsh, but the habitat is certainly suitable for them.
If someone's out there listening, maybe a casual or less casual bird watcher, is there a reasonable chance if they go to Horicon next summer they might spot some of these guys?
Yes. So there is an auto tour at Horicon Marsh, and there they have been seen in past years. So they very well may see a bird in that part of the refuge.
And is this a kind of bird, you know, you hear cranes, they'll migrate back and forth, they'll find a spot, they'll keep finding that spot again. Is that how these guys work with migration? Once they pick a place, there's a good chance they're going to come back?
There's no guarantee that they will come back to the exact same spot.
Mm-hmm.
But they may come back to a different spot in the marsh, a different site. With that many nesting pairs, and because they had good nesting success, I would expect to see birds back at Horicon next year.
In our last few moments, what was it like in that moment when you spotted for the first time ever your first chicks of this bird species?
I was more than delighted and absolutely, quite frankly, I was absolutely astounded because I had never seen a black-necked stilt in Wisconsin before, much less stilt with chicks. And because they lay four eggs, here they had good hatching success, all four hatched out. We later found out that the production, the number of young produced, was also very good. So it was really a remarkable event for both myself and Daryl Christensen.
Sumner, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Pleasure to be here.
That's Sumner Madison, conservation biologist with Wisconsin DNR. We talked to him today about black-necked stilts nesting for the first time, as far as we can tell, here in Wisconsin. Federal judge voided a Trump administration rule last week that would have expanded the ability of doctors and hospitals to refuse to perform certain procedures based on religious or moral grounds. These procedures included abortions or sterilizations, among other issues of conscience. In May, Wisconsin was one of 23 cities, states, and municipalities to file a lawsuit against that rule. That policy was set to go into effect later this month. However, the conscience rule is nothing new when it comes to federal policy. Laws passed in Congress and rules set by the executive branch have been part of the medical landscape for decades. Our next guest joins us to explain conscience rules and how they play a role in policy. Philip Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. Phil, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back, Rob.
Well, give us some background on conscience clauses. These weren't things created by the Trump administration. They've been in laws passed by Congress and clarified and altered by the executive branch over the years.
Yeah, so the history of this conscience rules extends really back to the early 1970s. There was Congress passed some amendments called the Church Amendments, that began to put some of these types of rules into federal statutes. Some other amendments passed in the 90s and early 2000s did the same. And really what the executive branch does is it sort of combines these different laws and then makes some regulations around these types of rules. And so the rule that the Trump administration made this past year was really a sort of a reintroduction of something that the Bush administration did in 2008, but which was repealed or taken out of service pretty quickly after it was passed. And so basically what the rule did was it expanded the federal government's ability to punish healthcare organizations that disciplined a doctor or a nurse, some other kind of provider, who refused to participate in a procedure to administer a drug perform a C-section other types of procedures that doctors and nurses believe violated their conscience or their religious beliefs. And so it was a really huge expansion. If this would have gone through, the federal government could have terminated funds for hospitals, federal funds, withheld federal payments, suspended award activities, basically as a much bigger federal hammer for for hospitals or other entities that the federal government identified as violating conscience rights.
And as you mentioned, these conscience rules date back to the early 70s. That's no coincidence. That's after the Roe versus Wade decision. Was a big part of this saying, okay, abortion is legal, but we're going to make it so that doctors and nurses who believe it's morally wrong don't have to participate in the procedure?
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that conservatives in the executive branch, when conservative presidents get elected, I think have really seen as an important tool for striking back against Roe versus Wade, despite the fact that it remains the law of the land. And so really what you've seen kind of both at the federal level with executive actions and at the state level with restrictions on admitting privileges for doctors who provide abortions and things of that nature has been an attempt to really just make it a lot harder to get an abortion, even if it is still, you know, technically allowed.
And prior to these or absent these Trump rule changes before they existed and after they're stricken down, there are protections, right, for healthcare providers when it comes to something like abortion. Is that right?
Yeah, there are protections, but I think the key thing that you should think about this rule doing is that it really expanded in a very big way what was considered as discrimination against healthcare providers who perform procedures. So to give an example, there was a case in New Jersey about 20 years ago where a nurse refused to assist in an emergency C-section because she believed it would lead to the termination of a pregnancy. The hospital that she was at offered to move her to a different unit. They offered to move her to the NICU. She refused, and then she was terminated. She sued in federal court, but the hospital won. Under this rule, she would be able to file a complaint, and the hospital could lose all of its federal funds. And so there's this real question about, one, to whom do these kind of conscience rights apply or rules apply? And two, what is actually considered a kind of procedure where these restrictions apply, and under the rule, even something as like a C-section, emergency C-section could have been covered under this rule.
Talking to Phil Rocco, political scientist and healthcare policy expert at Marquette University, looking at a rule put in place by the Trump administration that would have made it easier for healthcare workers to claim discrimination if they refuse to provide certain services over religious or ethical grounds. That decision struck down by a court after a lawsuit by states, including Wisconsin. You can join in with your thought on this idea of the conscience clause at 800-642-1234. As I mentioned, Wisconsin, Phil, one of the states involved in this lawsuit. We talked to Attorney General Josh Call earlier in the show. Here's what he had to say about what's happening at the state level here in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin and many other states already have conscience protections in place so that our public policy balances the ability of patients to get the care that they need with the ability of medical providers to opt out of procedures that they have moral or religious objections to providing. We have a carefully balanced law here.
So the attorney, Wisconsin's attorney general there, saying states have this under control, this Trump administration set of rules would preempt these state laws. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the larger issues that came up in this case. And what the plaintiffs in this case really alleged was that the Trump administration, in making this rule, went far beyond what these previous statutes that Congress passed allowed the federal government to do. Potentially violating other laws that existed, something like EMTALA, which requires people to be treated in emergency rooms, something called Title VII as well, that really sort of contradicted what this rule was trying to do. And so I think that, you know, one of the, you know, key things that we're going to have to look at is, number one, you know, does the failure of this rule go into place, does it spark legislative changes at the state level, for example, to, you know, intensify these conscience rules? Or does it, in fact, lead the Trump administration to go back and revise the rules they tried to make to maybe more narrowly tailor the rule? Because, again, right, these conscience provisions they're in a sense already in a few key federal statutes. What the court said in this case was that the Trump administration's attempt to regulate on this was really far too expansive for what the law currently allows.
And the judge in the case pointed to a claim by the Trump administration in implementing these rules that they'd seen a boom in complaints of discrimination under conscience objections, saying I think the number was 343 complaints received in a year. On closer inspection by the judge and in the court, it turned out it was something in the ballpark of 20. With that in mind, is this something that really comes up that much that there needs to be a big to-do about it?
Yeah, this is maybe one of the most interesting parts of the case, which is that, you know, when the federal government makes new regulations, it has to, by law, provide a truthful rationale for why it's doing what it's doing. And the Trump administration leaned hard on this idea that it had seen this sort of unprecedented volume of conscience rule complaints in the past few years. And what the administrative record, in fact, showed was that most of the letters that the federal government said it had received actually had nothing to do with the conscience rule. There were some of them that the federal government counted twice in its count of letters, and which is not to dismiss the objections that were raised in the letters that the federal government received. But if the point was that it was this overwhelming number of letters, that the evidence didn't really show that. And I think this is actually one interesting example. There are, in fact, other examples of the Trump administration doing this. And it's why we've seen a lot of lawsuits filed under something called the Administrative Procedures Act. But lawsuits related to the fact that the Trump administration's evidence that it's bringing to bear to justify its regulations or new rules that it's making is not necessarily airtight, and there are, in fact, a lot of evidentiary gaps or some pieces of the administrative record that really don't seem like the administration has done its homework.
Talking to Phil Rocco, assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. He's with us to talk about a recent ruling that voided a Trump administration rule allowing doctors and hospitals to refuse certain procedures based on religious or ethical grounds. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this ruling? Do you support the idea of conscience clauses where healthcare providers or systems can say they won't do certain services because of religious or ethical objections, or do you oppose them? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about the Trump administration's conscience rule that was recently overturned by a federal judge. Phil Rocco is with us, assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. And you can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. What do you think about rules that allow doctors or hospitals to refuse to provide certain medical services based on their religious, moral, or ethical beliefs? Should the government make these rules? Should they be stronger than they currently are? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. John is with us in Portage. John, hi.
Hello.
What'd you want to bring up, John? Yep, go ahead.
Okay. The speaker mentioned it. The rules go back to the 1970s, but they go back way farther than that. They go back to the Hippocratic Oath, which has the original version has a clause that says, I will not give a petri to a woman to induce an abortion. So this is nothing new. There are other examples that arise, one of which would be a doctor should be able to refuse to do female genital mutilation, for example. Or another example would be to refuse to prescribe Viagra, for example, to someone like Mr. Epstein.
John, thanks for the call. Phil, so, of course, the Hippocratic Oath is not a federal law, so the federal laws date back to the 1970s. But the argument that the Hippocratic Oath creates certain demands of doctors and requirements, our caller saying that they refuse certain services.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question that this raises, and I think one of the interesting political dimensions of this particular issue, is the role of sort of medical expertise and knowledge surrounding the procedures that are covered by these kinds of rules. And I think, again, one of the challenges that the judge identified in this case was that the rule, as sort of stated, would not merely include things like abortion or related procedures, but also things that were in certain ways much more questionably related to an individual's ethical or religious beliefs. So I think it's an interesting question is, you know, in what ways can regulations attempt to balance some of these concerns? Is it a sort of good tool? And, you know, to what extent does this actually issue need to return to sort of the legislative arena? Because in one sense, what the Trump administration is trying to do here sort of extended beyond the bounds of what Congress had said. And like, to what extent does this debate over the sort of the boundaries of medical knowledge need to re-enter the legislative arena?
John, thanks for the call. Going out to Mark in Hartford. Mark, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess my take on this whole thing is that when you go to a doctor or any medical professional to get help, you should really be able to get the help that you need or want in some cases. And I think that if religion comes into it, it makes me question the freedom of religion. Should it not be freedom from religion, that you don't have to worry about the person that you're going to see for help's beliefs in order to get better or take care of something medically?
Mark, thanks for the call. And that's a concern often raised about conscience clauses, Phil, is about the impact on patients seeking certain medical services.
Right. And that's sort of one of the interesting issues that was raised by the plaintiffs in the case, was whether or not this rule, in fact, violated the Establishment Clause of the Constitution, that government shall make no law establishing sort of a state religion. The judge ultimately rejected that argument, but I think the sort of the concern that was raised in sort of other parts of the decision was, in a sense, because of the overbroadness of the rule and the fact that there's so many different types of procedures that potentially it could have applied to. And I should say that this is not just related to abortion. It is also related to access to care for religious minorities, sex trafficking victims, LGBT folks. That religious and ethical exemptions actually extends far beyond the subject of abortion. That you know, the judge's sort of argument in the decision was that that it's actually very difficult to have all of those types of procedures covered, and sort of creates a problem of reliance. Right? Can patients sort of rely on providers to provide the care that they need?
Mark, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Phil Rocco from Marquette University about conscience clauses. A Trump administration rule was overturned by a judge. That rule would have greatly expanded federal enforcement of laws that allow doctors, nurses, other health care providers to opt out of providing services that they say contradicts their religious and ethical beliefs. We asked people what they thought of this on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Danita says, Yes, she supports the idea of a conscience clause, but only if it doesn't keep a patient from receiving those services in a timely and convenient manner. For example, a doctor, she says, in a hospital could excuse him or herself only if there's another doctor in the hospital that can provide the service the same day. And Phil, that's something that people talk about, the practicalities of something like this. Is there going to be that other doctor available?
Yeah, and I think this is one issue that really relates to not. It's interesting how many other issues this issue touches. So this relates to the true variation in access to care around the country. Having somebody else who can perform a needed procedure, like an emergency C-section, for example, might not be too hard in Newark, New Jersey, for example, at a hospital in Newark, New Jersey. But, you know, in a very remote place, critical access hospital in rural Pennsylvania, for example, finding somebody else to perform the procedure might be difficult, given scheduling and staffing limitations. That might be more difficult still. And so, you know, you like to imagine perhaps that there's just sort of one effect of this rule, no matter where you live or who you are. But the reality is the rule is going to, you know, if it had gone into effect, would really impact different communities differently. And I think that that's sort of one thing that in rulemaking that is important to think about, which is like, really, how will this impact the people that are covered by these policies? And the answer is, it really depends on where you live.
And Phil, in our last minute or so, what are you watching for on this issue of conscience protections for healthcare providers?
Well, I think there are three things that could be happening in the next few months. First, the rule was vacated, but the Trump administration could actually go back and revise it and try to come up with something more narrowly tailored. A second thing that the Trump administration could do is try to appeal the case up to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, and we'll have to watch for that decision as it comes out. And it's quite possible then that there would be a Supreme Court case perhaps next term on this. But for the moment, the rule has been vacated. Providers do not need to consider it for the moment going into effect. It's not the law of the land currently.
Phil, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
We've been talking to Phil Rocco, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. He joined us today to talk about a recent judge's ruling that voided a Trump administration rule that allowed hospitals or doctors to refuse certain procedures based on religious or moral grounds. The Trump administration would have strengthened enforcement of existing laws. That court decision means, as Phil just said, it is not currently the rule of the land. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a guest makes the case for five policies the U.S. should adopt that are all unpopular with the public. There's almost sure to be something you disagree with. We have that up at the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can go on there and disagree with it. Get a head start right now. The flu season is off to an early start in Wisconsin. A state disease expert joins the show with the latest on the spread of influenza and talks about efforts to get people vaccinated and the state of this year's vaccine and how well it matches up with what we're seeing so far in the actual virus. The curator of the International Spy Museum joins the show. He'll share some plans from the intelligence community over the decades that never quite made it off the drawing board. We'll meet the author of the new book called Nuking the Moon. That and look at some of the top news of the day. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.